Okay, great. So before we get started, let me introduce myself. I'm Michael Washam. I'm a senior technical evangelist focusing on Windows Azure for virtual machines, infrastructure, and service. So the session we're going to talk about today is the same topic. We're going to talk about virtual machines and virtual networks and go pretty deep into the various things you can do from an infrastructure and service offering. So before I get started, how many of you today have actually tried to deploy a virtual machine in Windows Azure? Okay, few. So this is a relatively new offering. We just came out with a preview in June. So hopefully this is a good introduction for everyone that hasn't actually had a chance to dig into it too well. So before I go too deep on Windows Azure Virtual Machines, I'm going to kind of give you a little history lesson of how we got to the point of needing virtual machines to deploy applications out to the cloud. So way back in 2007, I'm sure if you followed any Windows Azure talks before, you probably heard this story a lot, so I'm not going to go too deep in it. But way back in 2007, a bunch of really smart people at Microsoft all got together and came up with this project called Project Red Dog. Not going to go into the naming, that's Mark's talk. But Project Red Dog is the forebearer of what would later become Windows Azure. PDC08, we came out with the CTP of Windows Azure, and it came out with the offering of being able to deploy web and worker roles running partial trust .NET code only, which is a noble goal if your entire application is partial trust in .NET only. Unfortunately, not everyone's application works that way, so we came out later, a little bit later the next year, and we introduced support for running native code, so you could run full trust in the cloud. You could run PHP and Java. And then February, a little bit later, we actually RTM'd. And right after RTM, in November of the next year, we came out with a whole list of features. And I'm skipping over a whole bunch of other stuff not related to my talk here. But we came up with a bunch of other features. VMroll, which allows you to create a virtual hard disk image that your web and worker roles would boot off of. And it was really meant for on-ramping applications that took a really long time to install or that just weren't scriptable. So basically, it was a solution, kind of a hack, to allow you to run certain pieces of software up in the cloud. We also added Windows Azure Connect, which allowed you to do point-to-point networking. So you could install an agent behind your firewall on your on-premises server and have true hybrid networking over an IPv6 tunnel. In addition to those two, we added admin mode and startup tasks. So startup tasks is what, if you're not familiar with PaaS applications in Windows Azure today, it basically is a entry point that allows you to run a batch file or some kind of script to configure your environment when your role starts up. And admin mode, all it really is, hey, my script can run elevated because lots of software wasn't written with UAC in mind, and it requires elevated permissions. Also gave you remote desktop, which comes in extremely handy whenever you have to troubleshoot these startup tasks that you have to write. Then fast forward to November, we added lots of support for cross-language SDKs, Java, Node, et cetera. What all of this stuff has in common is it's all meant to help you run different pieces of your application or software up in the cloud. If you note, a lot of it's complicated, writing batch files. Connect is not, you know, it solves a lot. Solves a problem for building hybrid solutions, but a lot of system administrators don't like putting an agent on their domain controller. Just go figure. So what we're going to talk about today is hopefully the answer to allow you to on-ramp and migrate applications up to the cloud, the feature set that will help you do that, and it's called Windows Azure Virtual Machines. We start off with a really strong IT pro experience because everything that Windows Azure Virtual Machines is based on relatively familiar technologies that you're already, for the most part, used to, not all of it, keep in mind. So our entire infrastructure is based on virtual hard disks. If you use Hyper-V today, you're already familiar with how VHDs work. We use a lot of the hypervisor technology in Windows Azure to run these virtual machines. Another critical thing that we focused on for the initial launch was the ability to run some of Microsoft's key server workloads. We figure if we pick our toughest server workloads and we can successfully run them in the cloud, that should, by definition, open up the door for lots of other similar server applications. Stuff like Active Directory, SQL Server, full SQL Server, not just Windows Azure SQL databases, and SharePoint. SharePoint's one of the biggest applications you can possibly run on a Windows Server, and it will successfully run, so that should tell you a little bit about the technology. In addition to that, we have really straightforward, easy storage manageability. We don't require you to manage SANs. We really just give you tools where you can move around large amounts of data. We have high availability features with our virtual machines. The high availability features are at the data center level. So whenever you go off and deploy virtual machines in Windows Azure, you get the ability to actually pick your VMs to be on separate racks. So within the data center, you get physically separate hardware for high availability. In addition to that, we introduced a lot more above and beyond what we did with Windows Azure Connect to provide hybrid networking. Windows Azure Connect basically gave you machine-to-machine connectivity. It would allow you to open up an IPv6 tunnel from Windows Azure back behind your firewall to a server on your on-premises network. What we've introduced with this release is, it was codenamed Project Brooklyn. Apparently Mary Jo just figured that one out. But it was Project Brooklyn, and it allows you to do true site-to-site networking. So instead of opening up a machine to a machine, you can open up entire subnets within your network to Windows Azure and vice versa. And finally, we have a really strong past story with our web and worker roles. We wanted the ability to easily integrate, talk to virtual machines. So one of the big drawbacks, one of the big pushes we've had with customers trying to migrate to cloud services today is they need the ability to talk to other applications like SQL Server or Active Directory. So having the ability for PaaS applications to be on the same physical network as virtual machines, opens up all kinds of on-ramping opportunities. So before I go too deep, I do want to stop here with VMroll. So if you've never seen VMroll, if you're brand new to all of this and you go search for Windows Azure Virtual Machines or Windows Azure VMs, you'll likely be confused because before Virtual Machines, we did have VMroll. And VMroll was specific to a very, it was built for a specific scenario. And that scenario is you want to deploy software up into the cloud, and this specific piece of software you're deploying takes a really long time to install, 20, 30 minutes. Not really necessarily good for waiting on it before your application can start. And the other problem is if it's not scriptable at all. The only way you can install software on a PaaS role in Windows Azure is scripted. So if you have software that can't be scripted, by definition, it wouldn't work. So VMroll allowed you to actually create a custom VHD, a custom OS image that had all of your necessary customizations and changes, upload it to your Windows Azure storage account, and boot your PaaS web and worker roles off of it. That's pretty much the only use case you'll have for VMroll. So whenever you see any documentation on it, if you're looking for virtual machines, be clear that it's not the same thing. So to get started in virtual machines, talk through a couple of different scenarios on how this works. The first one I want to talk through is cloud-first provisioning. So cloud-first provisioning is exactly what it sounds like. It's instead of creating a virtual machine off-site on your laptop, on your desktop, or something, and uploading it, you're literally creating the virtual machine directly in the cloud. There's three different entry points you can use to provision a VM in the cloud. The first one is Windows Azure Management Portal. The second one is our scripting interfaces. We have PowerShell commandlets and cross-platform that'll run on Linux, Mac, and Windows. They're written in Node.js. And finally, if you need full automation, you can actually have full access to our REST API to do everything that the portal or the scripting interfaces can do. Once you've picked your entry point of getting started with VMs, you basically select the VM type, whether Windows Server 2008, 2008 R2, Server 2012, or various Linux distributions we now support. You pick the image type, the VM size, and what we'll do is we'll take a copy of that image and copy that VHD over to your Windows Azure storage account, and we'll boot your VM off of it. The second scenario I want to cover is bring your own server /VHD. What this is for is you have VHDs on premises that you want to move up to the cloud. If you're a SharePoint developer, this could be your the VHDs, your VMs that you run on your local machine test debugging your web parts. Tired of carrying around a giant laptop with massive amounts of memory and storage, you want to carry a little tablet around, put it all up in the cloud, and that's the use case for this. It's also useful for other things like migrating real applications, etc. But the general flow is you take your VHD, you upload it using tools that you found in Windows Azure SDK, upload directly to your storage account, and depending on what type of VHD you're uploading, whether it's what you'd consider an image or a disk, and I'll cover those in just a second, you'll create a VM off of it. The third scenario you can do directly in the cloud is creating the custom images in the cloud. So lots of enterprises like building a golden image that they use to provision all their new VMs based off of. It'll have all their software configurations, patches, whatever. You can do the exact same thing in Windows Azure. The general idea is you boot a VM off of it, you customize it, put software or policies, whatever you need to do for this VM. You generalize it. If this is Windows, you'll be running sysprep here to remove your machine name and any other unique aspects of it. If it's Linux, you'll run the Windows Azure agent that'll accomplish the same thing and generalize it. And from there, you run a feature that or run a click a button that we have called Capture. Capture essentially takes that virtual hard disk that you've customized in sysprep and puts it in the Windows Azure image library for your subscription. And from there, you can every VM that you boot off of it using that image will have identical starting settings. It'll everything that you put on the VHD will be available. So we are in preview. We just started preview June 6th, I think. And what we're launching with, we actually have added a couple of new ones since the initial launch. But what we have right now at preview is Server 2008 R2. We have various versions of it. One of them was SQL Server 2012 eval, and we just added one last week with BizTalk CTP on it. And we have the release version of Windows Server 2012. We also currently support four Linux distributions, with more likely to come in the near future. So your virtual machines in Windows Azure, one of the key differentiators between a virtual machine that we're talking about now and VMworld, which I talked about earlier, is your storage, your underlying disks are persistent. That may not seem, you know, shocking to you if you're just coming from hypervisor or anything, but VMworld previously, if you wrote something to the C drive and then we service sealed your service, whatever you wrote is gone. With VMs today, with virtual machines, all that data is persistent. And we actually store all the backend for your virtual machines in Windows Azure Storage. One of the nice features in Windows Azure Storage is it has built-in replication. So every blob that you put in Windows Azure Storage is actually replicated three times within storage. So it makes it really hard for us to lose your data. And Windows Azure Storage also has another knob you can turn that if you set it to enable geo-replication, it will replicate it to another data center, nearby data center, so you could reasonably have six copies of your VHD floating around to make sure we don't have any corruption. So a little bit more detail about the difference between a disk and an image. Both of them are physically the same file format. They're just a VHD. It's just how they're created that are differently, or how they're used, I should say. A disk, all a disk is a VHD that you have in your storage account that your VM is either booting off of, it has an bootable operating system on it, or it has data on it. That's all it is. What we consider an image is a bootable VHD that we have in an image library that we basically market read-only. So you never actually boot off the image, you boot off a copy of the image. So it's just a sysprep VHD is really all it comes down to. Real quick summary of what we have from our virtual machine sizing. I think the colors are kind of bad on that one, but if you've ever seen Windows Azure virtual machine sizes before, nothing has significantly changed between prior to this release and now, other than the last column, the number of data disks. So each virtual machine size can support a certain number of data disks. So if you look at an extra large VM, it can support up to 16 data disks, and each data disk can be up to a maximum of 1 terabyte in size. So technically, you could have a virtual machine with 16 terabytes of storage. And one other really interesting aspect of Windows Azure Storage that I'll point out is you can create that 16 terabyte VM, and you'll actually only pay for the storage that's actually written to the disk. So Windows Azure Storage is smart enough to know that if you have a 16 gig drive and you're using 500 megs of it, not to charge you for the other, you know, massive amounts of data that's unused. One other piece of storage information that I'll point out before we move on to show something interesting is disk cache settings. So by default, whenever you boot up a virtual machine, the OS disk has caching enabled. And what that means is whenever a write occurs to the OS disk, like paging file, something like that, it doesn't write immediately get written to Windows Azure Storage. It actually writes it to the local resource disk. That's pretty much okay because there's nothing interesting about your OS disk. It's your data that you have to be concerned about. You know, you don't want any kind of corruption occurring to your SQL MDB files or if you have Active Directory on the machine, the Active Directory DIT database. So your data disk by default has caching set to none. That means every time you write to it, it writes it directly out to Windows Azure Storage. You can modify those settings by default or using PowerShell, but it's just something to keep in mind when you boot up a SQL server and you try to add a database to it, you need to configure storage first. Put your databases on a data disk. So now that we've seen a little bit or learned a little bit about how all this stuff works, let's flip over and actually create something. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and just walk through the how you would actually get started running virtual machines. So if I wanted to create a new virtual machine, I go into the Windows Azure Management Portal. I have two options. A quick create option basically just gives you an image name, and the from gallery option gives you a little bit more advanced functionality. So once you enter the OS selection, you see that we have three different filters. You have the platform images. These are the OS images provided out of the box in Windows Azure. So your BizTalk, SQL, Linux, VMs, et cetera. And you also have a selection over here called My Images. So if you do create a customized image, it will show up in here. You have a little bit of method of filtering out, because imagine after using it for a while, you'll actually have a quite long list of images available. And also you have a disks section that you can create of. So in this case, I have a SharePoint VM disk that I've uploaded that I could literally just create a virtual machine and boot off this VHD off of it. So for this one, I'm going to go ahead and create a new server 2012 VM. Give it a machine name, set the admin password, and at the bottom is where you actually get to pick the instance size. So small, medium, large, extra large. So the next option, you have two different scenarios you can choose whenever you're creating a VM. You have standalone mode and connect to an existing virtual machine. What this does is behind the scenes when you create a virtual machine, there's a container called a cloud service created. And this cloud service basically has a public IP address associated with it. So if you need the virtual machine to have its own public IP address, you make it a standalone virtual machine. If you want it to be on the same network as another virtual machine, you have it connect to an existing virtual machine. And I'll go into cloud services a little bit more. So I'm going to go ahead and make this standalone. And the other option you have here is which data center you're going to deploy it to. So you can see you have quite a few different data centers. And you can pick the VM or pick the data center, and it'll provision it in that data center. And the last option is availability sets. I'll cover availability sets a little bit later, but suffice it to say, this is what allows you to provision a VM in a different rack than another VM in your deployment. And that's pretty much all there is. It'll take about 10 to 15 minutes to boot up, but once it's booted up, the connect button at the bottom will light up, and you can literally RDP right into the VM. So now that you've seen the basics of how to create a virtual machine in the portal, let me show you how you can actually configure one. So I have another server here, server 2012-15TB, and you can guess 15TB stands for 15 terabytes. I have lots of data disks already attached to it. So each one of these is an actual data disk that's backed by Windows Azure Storage. So if I take a look at that URL and using something like Cloud Explorer, I can go into the container. You can see that all the underlying VHDs that are backed by that virtual machine. What's really nice, one of the really nice things about Windows Azure Storage is the ability to easily manage this stuff. So say, for instance, this was a big chunk of analytical data and I needed to move it to a different VM for troubleshooting or whatever. I can literally copy, make another container and paste this. Paste that and literally make a copy of 15 terabytes in just a few seconds. So Windows Azure Storage has lots of benefits, and that's why they chose it as a backend for creating virtual machines. So what does this actually look like once you're RDP'd in? How do you configure the disks? So let me RDP into this server. And one thing I did mention is that you can have up to 16 data disks. And if you see the number at the bottom right here, it shows I have 15, but that's also including the OS disk. So that means I really only have 14 data disks right now. If you want to add an additional data disk to this VM, all that's required is at the bottom. You have two options, attach disk and attach empty disk. If I want to add a new empty disk to this VM, log out. I can set the size of the disk. Click OK, and Windows Azure will, behind the scenes, create the VHD and attach it to your VM. So what this looks like in Disk Manager I go into Computer Manager, and under Disk Management, you can see it'll pop up and tell me that I have lots and lots of uninitialized disks. So at this point, I just click OK, and it'll initialize them. And the next thing I need to do with an uninitialized disk is actually format it. So as soon as it comes back, I can right-click on any of the disks. I can create any of the software RAID is supported, span volume, stripe, et cetera. So I can pick a stripe volume, take all my disks, and I'll call it big drive and quick format so we're not here all week. So that's how you manage additional storage on your virtual machine. So now the question is, how do I take a VHD that already exists? So say I have a data disk on a server in my on-prem network, and I want to upload it and use it on a virtual machine. So to show that, I'm going to actually just create a new VHD. We'll walk through the process of how you can actually upload it. I'm not going to make a giant one, though. I know the network here isn't that great. So I'm just going to go ahead and create a new VHD. Call it my data disk. And I'll set it to 50 megs. So what this will do is once you do this in Disk Manager, it'll actually create the disk, and it'll mount it to your file system. Of course, after you format it. So we should pop up with an E drive with a whopping 50 megs. What I'll do is let me copy my presentation over. Okay. And now I'm going to detach that. So I'm removing the VHD from unmounting it from my laptop. And what I'm going to do is show you how you can use CSUpload to actually upload that VM or that VHD. So CSUpload.exe is a utility that comes with the Windows Azure SDK. And here's it's not as simple to use as it looks. One thing you do have to do is you have to have your management cert set up on your local machine so it can manage your Windows Azure subscription. And there's documentation on how to get that set up. But once that part is set up, the only command line that you need to do to add a disk is use the add disk parameter, specify the local path, the literal path of where the data disk is, and then the destination. So I'm going to upload this to the same storage account that my other VHDs are. And a couple other nice things about using CSUpload is whenever it uploads, it's actually really intelligent on how it works. If you have a 50 gig VHD file and you've only written 10 gigs to the VHD, I mean, leaving 40 free, it calculates how much empty space is in the VHD, and it literally only writes the bits that are written to when it uploads. So out of 50 gigs, it'll save you 40 gigs of empty time when you upload it. The other thing that's really nice about it is Windows Azure currently only supports fixed data disks or fixed disks. So if you're your VHD is set to dynamically expanding for hypervisor, it automatically converts it on the fly as you upload it, so you don't have to go back and use Hyper-V Editor to edit the disk first. So this actually uploaded the disk to Windows Azure. I need to refresh, though, because the portal doesn't know that I did something behind the scenes on it. So once it refreshes, you can see when I'll go to attach. And I'll show my data disk here. And what happens on the other end, it sometimes takes anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes for this to pop up. So I might not wait for it. But what should happen is I'll get a new drive letter popped up that has my PowerPoint file on it. But right now my other disks are still formatting. So we'll come back to that and see when the drive actually gets popped up. So let's talk a little bit more about virtual machines and cloud services, just go into the architecture of how all this stuff is built. So the interesting thing about all this is virtual machines are architected on the exact same service model that Windows Azure Web and Worker Roles are modeled on. So if you're unfamiliar with Windows Azure today, how it works is you typically have a cloud service, and inside of the cloud service, you'll have multiple roles. They could be web roles, they could be worker roles, or VM roles for that matter. And each role can have a certain number of instances. So if I have a web role running my ASP.NET application with 3 instances, this is kind of what it would look like. And I could have a worker role with multiple instances. Virtual machines are architected in a very similar manner, except each virtual machine is itself a role, and each virtual machine role can only have 1 instance. And the reason that's interesting is because there are some limitations on how many roles you can have in a cloud service. Currently, the role limit is 25 roles per cloud service. So that means you can currently have 25 VMs per cloud service. That doesn't mean your application is only limited to 25 because you can actually span cloud services via networking. But currently, that's just something that you have to consider when you're deploying this. Another thing that I want to point out is, notice how it says implicit cloud service. Whenever you create a virtual machine, and it's the only virtual machine showing up, you'll actually not see the cloud service in the Windows Azure Management Portal. When you add another virtual machine to the same cloud service, it'll magically show up. That was a design decision, and if you ever wonder, hey, where's my cloud service? Now you know why. Essentially, the other thing that's interesting about cloud services is they do form a networking boundary. So if you have server A that needs to talk directly to server B, you add them to the same cloud service, they can ping, they have full networking capabilities between each other. So let me show a little bit more about how that works. So the first question you should be wondering is, how do I know what my cloud service name is? Not that it's that critical, but it's not apparent. If you look in Windows Azure Management Portal for your VM, the only way you'll know what your cloud service is if you look at the DNS entry. The cloud service name is actually the public host name for your cloud service URL. So we saw TechEd AU 2012. If I go back over to cloud services, we don't see a TechEd AU 2012. It's just not there. Now, on the other hand, if I go over to PowerShell, and I select all my service names for my subscription, you'll see that we actually do have it. So it's basically a hidden cloud service whenever it only has one VM in the service. So how you fix that is by adding another virtual machine to it. Not that that's an actual fix. So I'm going to go ahead and create a Ubuntu server. And with Linux, you actually get the opportunity to pick the username. And to connect the server to my Windows server, I'm going to select the second option here. Whenever you connect to an existing virtual machine, you get a couple of options. You basically have standalone virtual machines. You have the different, what they consider a cloud service already. So if I connect to the server 2012-15TB, it will convert it to a cloud service. So the important thing is it'll actually put these two on the same network. All right, and so while that Linux VM is spinning up, I'll flip over, refresh, and see if it shows my cloud service yet. Sometimes you don't have to wait for it to be provisioned before that changes. And there it is. So here in a little while, I'll show you how we can actually do some network connectivity between the two once that VM is finished booting up. All right, so a little bit about availability. So Windows Azure, prior to June, only had 1 service level agreement, and that was 99.95 for PaaS roles that had multiple instances of the same role. With virtual machines, we realized that not every application needs to have multiple instances of it. You know, line of business applications that have 3 users a day probably don't need 2 VMs servicing them. And a lot of applications aren't even designed to work correctly whenever there's more than 1 instance. So we introduced another service level agreement, which is 99.9. What's included in that 99.9 is basically everything that Windows Azure can do wrong. So everything that happens in the data center, network failures, power failures, disks, anything hardware related or management related of the actual data center itself. The only thing really not included is whatever self-inflicted damage you do by installing drivers or whatever software, and guest OS updates. So that's the new service level agreement. So the question is, from a virtual machine perspective, since you can only have one instance, how do you get to 99.95? And the answer is through an availability set. The availability set is a setting that whenever you actually create the virtual machine, that you can tell Windows Azure to behave in a slightly different manner. And what you're telling Windows Azure is, I have two different virtual machines, but they're doing the same job. Right, I could have two virtual machines running IS, or it could be 10 virtual machines for that matter, or I have multiple virtual machines running SQL Server, and treat them effectively as instances of the same thing. And what this actually does is physically separates the virtual machines on two different racks in a data center. So let me explain how vault and update domains work with Windows Azure today with our web and worker roles. So whenever we deploy a web role, and say it has four instances and a worker role of four instances, what we do is we actually put those on separate vault domains in the data center. So part of your application will be on data, rack one, and part of your application will be on rack two. So if we lose an entire rack in the data center, part of your application is still alive, still up and running. And we also have a concept of update domains. So whenever you deploy a new package with your application in it, or we behind the scenes are running patches on the host operating system, we know that not to update all the virtual machines at the same time. This basically tells the Windows Azure Fabric Controller how to do a rolling upgrade to your service. Virtual machines are slightly different because we only have single instances. So what we do is, instead of grouping it by instance, we actually group it at the role level. So I can create multiple virtual machines, say IS1 and IS2 and SQL1 and SQL2, and have each of them in their own availability set. And that will tell Windows Azure Fabric Controller to separate the VMs on separate racks for faults and for separate update domains as well. So it won't update SQL1 and SQL2 at the same time. So if you have a SQL mirroring running, it actually will not be completely down at the same time whenever we run our patches. So let's move on to Windows Azure Networking. So Windows Azure Networking, there have been a massive amount of new changes, specifically to support virtual machines. The first thing that I want to highlight is, if you've used PaaS roles before, the names are auto-generated for your application. So whenever you're trying to discover all your web and worker roles, you literally have to use a service model to figure it out. There's not a whole lot of upfront defining you can do. With Windows Azure VMs, whenever you create a virtual machine, the machine name you give it is what you get. And by default, whenever you add these two VMs to the same cloud service, you'll actually get a name resolution between the two. You ping SQL VM1, and it will respond with the right IP address. And how that works is, we actually provide a multi-tenant DNS server built into the platform. We just call it Windows Azure Provided DNS. So all VMs in the same cloud service, whenever they boot up, they register their name with this DNS server, and name resolution just works. It does not span cloud services, but everything within the same cloud service will resolve. The second option you have is to bring your own DNS server. So you can actually point to an on-premises DNS server. So if you're hosting AD, you're booting VMs up and they're AD joined, you can actually configure the virtual networking to use a DNS server in your on-prem network. Of course, you can deploy DNS in Windows Azure itself, or you can use public DNS too if you'd like. A few other interesting changes, or interesting things to point out, is we now support UDP traffic. So we support incoming traffic that's incoming load balance traffic for UDP, and we also allow outbound UDP, which is why outbound DNS now works. If you're new to Azure, that's not a big deal, but if you're previous to Azure, you're like, finally. From VM to VM IP communication, it's a little different, too. With PaaS roles, you actually have to explicitly define which ports can communicate within your service. For virtual machines, it's totally different. There's actually no layer of blocking protocols between your virtual machines. So ICMP won't work, TCP, UDP. If you want to do DCOM in between your virtual machines, it all works. Now, another interesting aspect of how we do, of using cloud services as an architecture, is that we have multiple virtual machines behind a single public IP address. So that opens up the question of how do you access each virtual machine on the same service for behind a specific port. And what we do is we use port-forwarded endpoints, and I'll show you how that works here in just a bit. But if you've ever set up a router or a firewall and tried to access a couple of your machines from behind it at home, you've probably already done this. And the last thing that we've added from our load balancing perspective is the concept of using custom health probes. If you've ever used Traffic Manager allows you to set basically an HTTP URL that tells Traffic Manager whether your service is healthy or not for an entire endpoint. The load balancer health probes do that at the virtual machine level. So for whatever service you have, you can actually specify an HTTP endpoint, and that HTTP endpoint can check the value, check the health of the service, check whether SQL's up and running, check whether your website can, you know, register a new user, it can check whatever it wants. And as long as it returns an HTTP 200, the load balancer is happy and keeps the node in the load balancer. If it returns anything other than a 200, it automatically boots it. So a little diagram of how this works. So behind in this little diagram, we have a cloud service. Has multiple virtual machines, both listening on port 3389 for RDP. And the question is, how do you access 3389 for VM1 or VM2 whenever there's only one public IP? And the answer is you basically create multiple endpoints for each virtual machine. One of them would listen on 5586, and one listen on 5587, and they would forward to the right port internally. Load balance sets, all a load balance set is whenever I create an endpoint on a virtual machine, I can tell it to be part of a load balance set. So VM1 could listen on 80, VM2 and VM3, and as long as the set name all matches, the load balancer will automatically distribute traffic for them in a round robin fashion. And custom probes is this basically just some additional properties on top of a load balance set that allows you to specify the URL that tells the load balancer whether that specific node is healthy or not. So let's jump into a few demos on how Windows Azure Virtual Networking works. Windows Azure Virtual Networking. Okay, so before I jump into that, let me see if my disk ever surfaced. That's the problem with doing IaaS demos is they take time to provision and boot, so you have to do a little cooking show magic. So log back into the server. And let's see. All right, so my big drive showed up, but my PowerPoint drive did not. Maybe it didn't like it since it's still formatting. So we'll try that one more time. Now that the drive's all formatted, it shouldn't take quite so long. But if you can look, the big drive is basically 14 terabytes of data free. All right, and we'll switch back to that here in just a second, whenever this guy right here completes. And whenever you do an operation in Windows Azure, one of the things you should know is that all the operations are async. So whenever I add a data disk, it throws the API, or it throws it off to the Windows Azure API, but you still have to wait around for the result to happen. So down at the bottom, you'll see a little blinking green arrow status that tells you something's working or not. So while it's chugging away, let's take a look at some of our virtual networking, or our networking. So I keep saying virtual networking, that's actually something we'll talk about shortly. So from a networking perspective, let's take a look at the Linux VM we spun up just a little while ago. So it's booted up. And it's actually in the same cloud service as our Server 2012 VM. So in theory, we should have network connectivity between the two. Of course, my management portal is not going to load on me, so. All right, so on a Linux VM, one thing to know about how you connect to Linux via SSH is if you create a standalone Linux VM, by default, the port will be traditional SSH on 22. If you add the VM to a cloud service that already has a virtual machine, it picks a random public port because they didn't check to see whether the 22 is already taken or not. So this one, if I want to SSH into this Linux VM, it's actually on port 64.965. So I'll use PuTTY here to log in. It's still thinking about it. So how many of you actually use Linux in your applications today? Okay. So a decent amount. Oh. Let me check one more. That's the type of the port. Okay, so the name of the server, the name of the other server is TechEd AUS 2012. So I'm just going to try to use ping. Oops. AUS 2012. That sure looks right. All right, let me make sure that it actually is in the right cloud service. Oh, let's see. Sorry. It's server 2012-15TB. I was looking at the cloud service name. Again, this is why it's important to know all these names are. So the name of the server is SRV2012-15TB. And we do get name resolution. So right off the bat, we know that Windows Azure provided DNS is working. But we're not getting any responses. Any ideas as to why? I told you just a second ago that VM-to-VM communication, it's 100% open. There's nothing stopping you at Windows Azure level. Firewall, that's right. So being Windows Azure Infrastructure as a Service, you have to manage stuff again. So what that means is we need to run back over to our Windows Server Box and pull up Windows Firewall. And go down to ICMPv4 and hit enable. So now when we go back to PuTTY, we open up ICMP. It's just like magic. So that shows you that VM-to-VM communication does indeed work, but you do have to remember to open up your firewall. And that goes for SQL Server or IS or whatever you're working on. So the next thing I want to show you on networking is how the load balancer works. So let me... I have a web farm that I've already deployed here, ISVM1 and ISVM2. So these machines are just two web servers in a cloud service. And what I want to do is I want to deploy an application out to them so I can show you how the load balancer works. So I'm going to pull up Visual Studio. Yes, I'm still running the RC. Hope to be going to the release as soon as I get enough time to do it. And I'm going to pull up it's just a real basic MVC4 app. And one of the things I've already done with these VMs is I've already deployed web deploy onto them, so I can just publish to them just like you can with any other website. So the significant code change I have is right here. I'm getting the computer name from environment.machine_name and updating the output of the web app to show you what machine name it's actually running on. So I'll go ahead and publish this code out. And if you're curious what the publishing profile looks like for deploying to a VM, is I've deployed web deploy on 8080, and I have it set to with a scheduled task to do synchronization between the VMs every hopefully every minute, but I don't know for sure. So this will go ahead and publish out to my web form, and then we should be able to see the load balancer actually behaving right. You know, I will warn you, one of my VMs was acting insanely sporadic earlier today, so this may be a short demo. But every reason to believe it will work. So if you look at what server the code is running on right now, it's ISVM2 form. So I hit Control F5 a few times, you can see that now we're on ISVM1 form. So we are indeed load balanced. And if you look at the load balancer settings, for that endpoint, it's pretty straightforward. You can see that we have load balanced machines, ISVM1 farm and ISVM2 farm. Now, I did do this a little differently. Whenever you create an endpoint in the management portal, the only options you get are the public port and the private port for port forwarding. What I wanted to do on this one is to actually add a custom health probe. And currently, the only way you can do that is from the scripting interfaces. So the command I use to generate this is right here. So I called one of the PowerShell commandlets, get Azure VM, and I call add Azure endpoint, and I basically specify the home/health check parameter and tell it what port to listen on for the health probe. Now, whatever it responds to on that health check, as long as it responds to it to 100, the load balancer is happy. Anything else, unhappy. So to demonstrate that, I have my health check handler here. And in the real world, this health check function would actually do something useful, like make sure I can still do some kind of transaction. But in this world, all I'm going to do is verify that if the request is indeed on the ISVM1 form, I'm going to throw an exception, 500, and the load balancer should boot it out. So I'll go ahead and publish this change. Then we can look at the logs and see how this actually works. So one thing I will complain about with the load balancer, there's no current status. There's nothing I can do and say, hey, tell me what all nodes are in the load balancer and what their status is. You can get what all nodes are in the load balancer, but you have absolutely no idea what their status is yet. Hopefully that's something that we're working on. But if you do notice through your own health check that for some reason certain nodes aren't processing requests, how you can troubleshoot that is basically by looking at the web logs of your web servers, whatever is on the other end of that. So I'm going to RDP into ISVM1 farm and show you what the actual request looks like. That's assuming my sync job went well. I think part of the problem I'm having with my demo is I got the sync job going way too fast, so it's starting to synchronize whenever it's already synchronizing. But assuming my content copied over, we should be good. So I'm going to go ahead and look at the log files real quick. You can see, the last few requests have been from the load balancer agent, and they were all 200s, meaning everything was good, all the way up until I made that code change, which now it's returning back to 500. So if I go back to my load balancer, if I go back and I hit F5 a few times, I should only see ISVM2 farm, because as far as the load balancer is concerned, this node's dead. So you can make that health probe as advanced and crazy as you want to do, as long as you know that the basic chart should respond 200 for good and anything else for bad. Okay, so one other demo I want to show you real quick on networking is port forwarding. I think you kind of already got the idea. I want to show you a real quick demo to show you how it works. So for this virtual machine, this is running a copy of Ubuntu Linux on it, and I have already defined an endpoint on it. Let me show you what that endpoint looks like. It's RDP. It's exactly what all the Windows Server ones. So So one common question, if you're brand new to Linux and you're brand new to Azure, I get when I talk to customers, hey, I created a Linux VM, and I go down to the connect button, and it doesn't do anything. It's disabled. So if you look at how the connect button is, it is actually enabled for this virtual machine. And the reason is because I have an RDP endpoint. That's all Connect is looking for, because we don't have a built-in SSH client in Windows, but we do have a remote desktop. So what you can do, if you want to impress your non-Linux friends, is you can actually install RDP onto Linux and connect to it through Windows Azure. So I've already defined the endpoint, so it should be anything looking for that public endpoint will be forwarded to port 3389. So now the only thing I got to do is make something listen on the other end for port 3389. If I look at netstat, right now we don't have, there's currently nothing listening on port 3389. We have 22 and every other random port, but not that one. So what I'm going to do is install XRDP package. It'll take just a few minutes. Starting a remote desktop protocol server. You can't read that. And we're done. So now, when I hit connect, it should actually do something. A little different. But through the magic of port forwarding and basics of Linux, you can actually have a full-blown Linux desktop running up in Windows Azure. All right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about networking. Go a little deeper, though. Instead of just machine-to-machine, let's talk about site-to-site virtual networking. So as I mentioned before, we have two different technologies for doing hybrid networking. The first one is called Windows Azure Connect, which allows you to do a point-to-point networking, basically by installing an agent on a machine back in your on-premises data center. The downside to this is it is point-to-point, machine-to-machine, and it also requires an agent, which means if you have a non-Windows server in your data center, there's no way to wire it up. However, with site-to-site network connectivities and Windows Azure Virtual Networks, you essentially are using VPN devices for your network connection. There's no agent involved at all, and it's at a true VPN site-to-site level. So Windows Azure Virtual Network essentially allows you to create your own virtual branch office up in the cloud. So if you need to move existing workloads up to the cloud, or you're creating new applications that have to have access to resources on-prem, this is probably the right technology. So all a hybrid application is some application you have over on the right running in the cloud that needs to access resources on premises. So this could be SharePoint, it could be Active Directory, it could be any application that needs access back. So in addition to, whenever I talk about Windows Azure Virtual Networks, by definition, everyone always assumes that it's all about site-to-site networking. It does come in handy even without a VPN router. And the reason is because it basically allows you to connect all your virtual your resources in Windows Azure through a public network or through a private network. So I showed you cloud services, how I can have two VMs on the same network. Well, what happens if you another group within your company has their own cloud service within their own virtual machines, and occasionally those two services need to talk to each other? Well, you can actually create a virtual network that all of your cloud services will be in the same private network. They all have network connectivity within the same data center. One thing to note, though, currently, whenever you deploy a VM into a VNet, a virtual network, you do not get the built-in virtual or Windows Azure DNS. So that's a drawback that we're working on ASAP because it's really painful to deploy a bunch of VMs and try to track them by their IP addresses. You can, of course, use your own DNS, so if you're doing AD, it's not a problem at all. It's whenever you have when you don't have a DNS solution that makes it really tough. So I'm going to put together a real quick demo. Hopefully, it's real quick. It takes quite a bit of time. But what I'm going to show you is how to wire up a Cisco device to connect to Windows Azure and move a SharePoint VM from on-prem up to the cloud. So you're going to see a true site-to-site network connection and a virtual machine migration. how many of you have ever configured a Cisco device? All right. So I haven't either up until about a week ago. No. So what I'm going to walk through is creating a new virtual network for our subscription. So I'm going to go ahead and click New Network, and I'll call this Hybrid VNet Demo. And for hybrid, for virtual networking, you do have to pick an affinity group. All the resources within a virtual network have to be in the same data center, so you can't have a virtual machine on the East Coast and a VNet on the West Coast. Not yet, unfortunately. That would be really great. We don't have it just yet. So the first thing you need to do to define your virtual network is define the address space of all the different, whenever you boot a VM or a PaaS roll up, what IP address is it going to get? This is basically given a DHCP scope for your virtual network. So I'm going to give it 10.1.0.0/16. That way I can have millions and millions of hosts up in the cloud, like it'll ever happen. The one thing you do need to remember whenever you are building site-to-site networks is make sure that this address space does not overlap address space that you have on-premises, because they will be part of the same network once you establish a connection, and you could have all kinds of interesting results if we're allocating your on-prem IP addresses. So next thing I need to do is define a subnet. So I'm going to go ahead and actually I'll call this a SharePoint subnet. So a little secret on why you have to do subnets, because if you've taken networking before, you're always like, okay, so I need to do subnets to isolate broadcast storms and for routing and blah, 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 blah. So A, we don't support broadcast in the cloud, so you'll never have a broadcast storm. And B, we don't support routing. So the question you ask is, why do subnets at all? And the answer is, we will someday do routing. Oh, sorry. Don't bump your mic. But in the near future, on our immediate roadmap, is we are going to support ACLing between subnets, because that is really critical for doing Active Directory DMZ type work, right? You need to be able to lock down traffic between these subnets. So whenever you're deploying it now in preview, plan for eventually having routable traffic. So I'm going to go ahead and create one subnet here called SharePoint subnet, and I'm going to create a new DNS server. And this is actually a server that's back on my desk in Redmond. It's an IP address. It's just a VM that I have running AD back in Redmond, Washington. So the next thing I need to do is configure connection to the local network. So I'm going to give, I need to give it a gateway subnet. Whenever you create a gateway in Windows Azure, what it actually does behind the scenes is it provisions two worker roles in your subscription. And those worker roles basically need to know what subnet to boot up in. And this is what that subnet is for. And I'm going to tell it to create a new local network. And for my on-prem network, I need the public IP address of my VPN device. So luckily, I wrote that down. So this is a public IP address of a Cisco device sitting back in my desk in Washington. I'll go ahead and plug that in here. And I need to give it the address space of my local network. So, and why you need the address space is whenever it establishes a VPN tunnel, it uses it as a perimeter to figure out what traffic is routable. So I can add multiple addresses here. So I can have, you know, if you have five subnets on your on-prem network that needs to talk to your Windows Azure network, you would add all five here. But luckily, there's only two machines, so I have a little tiny subnet. So /24. And I click OK. And that is, for the most part, the end configuration I need to do on the Windows Azure side. Now, that doesn't mean I'm done. Once this is booted up, I need to create, actually provision a gateway, because all this actually doesn't create the gateway yet. When you go into the network, you see the big red and gray, it's not connected icon. What you have to do next is click the Create Gateway button at the bottom. So whenever this is officially live, this is when the billing will start. So once these gateways provision, that's whenever you'll get the hourly connection charge. Now, normally it takes about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes for the gateway to provision. So like a good cooking show host, I have another hybrid virtual network with a gateway already provisioned. See how fast that was? So now we're going to take the next step of actually configuring the on-prem Cisco device to connect to this and establish a tunnel. To do that, there's a button down at the bottom, download. And it gives me the option of using Cisco or Juniper. So we don't support a lot of devices yet. However, if they support the magic set of protocols, chances are really good that it'll work. So I'm going to go ahead and select Cisco. That's what I have. And click OK. And this is going to generate a device script, configuration script that I'm going to use to configure my device. So now this is basically configuring everything that you just saw in Windows Azure, setting up the networks for on-prem and VNet and the subnet ranges. You're going to do the exact same thing in this script, and I'm going to run it against the device, and it'll create the exact same configuration. It's kind of nice. So the first thing I need to do is probably up my font size. There's a lot of these little angle brackets. Anytime you see an angle bracket in the script, it means you need to replace it with something useful. So RP Azure Network, that is basically the name of the network object that we're going to create in your Cisco device. So I'll just call it Azure Network. On-prem network, the exact same. It's wanting to know what the on-prem network object should be called. These are literally just object names that are associated with configuration in your device. And for the Azure Network, I need to configure the device IP range. So I'll do 10.1.0.0, just like I did in Windows Azure, and the subnet mask. It was class B, so made it class B. Now I need to do the exact same thing for my on-prem network, which was 192.168.1.0, and the subnet mask is a class C, so 3255s. And now it's really just a bunch of find and replace. So when I see RP access list, I'm going to name this Azure access list. Because whenever we run this on a device, you'll see it's going to actually take this little command and create an ACL that allows traffic between my on-prem network and talk to my Azure network. That's really all this command access list does. Now, a few other things I need to change is I need to set the transform set. You don't have to modify the protocols or anything. That's essentially the script generates all the right configuration. You just have to generate the right name so whenever your network administrator looks at it, he has some idea what you did. Hopefully he's actually doing this, though, because this gets pretty hairy. And the crypto map. We got a few more things. So there's two more pieces of information that we need, the gateway IP address and the key. So you can get the gateway IP address from the portal. And paste. And then you need the key. And you can get the shared key. This is the shared key that that will be used to negotiate the VPN tunnel. So we take all this, copy it, and now I need to RDP into my device back in Redmond. See how laggy this is going 7,000 miles away. Okay, not too bad. So this is the admin tool for the Cisco device. I don't know it well enough to go do SSH and all that good stuff, but I can get close by running that command line. Basically, I'm going to paste that script in and hit send. Hit close, and once it calculates the script finishes running, it should pop up a refresh button. Hopefully. Maybe I hit the wrong button. See, this has never happened before until now. Oh, let me double check, make sure I didn't get a typo. Actually, the fastest way to look for typos is look for brackets. Make sure you didn't miss anything. Here, let me... if it never comes back, you'll know why. this is actually really risky, managing your entire networking configuration over RDP, because if you mess it up, you're kind of toast. So, and I have done that. I've literally called people in the next office, hey, can you go reboot my device? Okay, so we'll see what settings it comes up with and try to run that command one more time. Okay, so it actually, assuming that's the same thing, that 82. Yeah, okay, so it claims to have got my settings. So let's make sure that everything got created that's supposed to get created. So I get a tunnel group. I get a crypt, the same crypto map that we just made. There should be an ACL. So on-prem network, Azure network. Basically, everything we just defined in the script is here, so I'll work off the assumption that it kind of worked. So at this point, the Windows Azure Gateway should be trying to connect back to the Cisco device and establish a connection. Usually, this takes about anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes for it to actually work. So while that's working, let's flip over and actually show the next step. Oh, looky there, it's already connected. So it actually worked in my favor. So the next step is, how do I take a VM that needs access from on-prem resources and move it up to the cloud? So I have a VM here. It's a SharePoint VM. It's already running. It's in this in hypervisor running locally on the machine back in Redmond. And you can see that when I ping this guy, I'm getting a 192.168.1.13. It's a local address. So what I want to do is, you know, let me show you how fancy my app is. It is a really cool SharePoint app. It's never been initialized before, so it might take a while to compile. But the interesting thing here I can do, oh, there it is. So it's basically just your very bland team side. I have done absolutely no changes to it whatsoever. But the important thing is here is it actually is using Windows Active Directory. So I have to log in with Windows authentication. It's using system account, which is fabric.cam/administrator, and all the service accounts are AD. So what I want to do is migrate this guy to the cloud. So I'm going to go ahead and hit shutdown and get shut it down locally, because I don't want multiple instances of it booting up in AD, because AD will get really confused. So one thing I will say is, if you're a System Center user, there's a really nice tool that they have called App Controller that now supports the exact same thing I'm going to show you using tools. So if you want to try this at home and you're a System Center fan, grab the beta of App Center. It should be up this week or next, and you can basically do the exact same thing using a nice GUI. So just like before with CS Upload, I have a command line script called CS Upload that takes a VHD, uploads it, and I'm going to run upload VM, and it is about 50 gigs to upload this, so, you know, as long as you guys feel like waiting about 4 hours, we can finish this demo. But again, I cheated, so I'll go ahead and kill the upload. This is what you would normally do if you're going to do this demo, is you would wait about 2 to 3 hours for it to finish uploading. But I've already uploaded this VM, so I'm going to go ahead and actually boot this guy up. So I'm going to say new virtual machine from gallery. I'm going to pick my disks, SharePoint VM. So one I previously uploaded, SharePoint app. I think I have just enough quota left to do 2 cores. And you notice you have an option of, whenever you're looking at the different data centers, you can deploy it to a virtual network as well. So the one I'm going to deploy it to is called Hybrid VNet, the one that we just connected. And I'm going to put it on the SharePoint subnet and click OK. So whenever this boots up, remember when I walked to the wizard, I actually configured an on-prem DNS server that happens to be the domain controller back on-prem. So whenever this boots up, it'll see the domain, it'll get the new IP address, and it should just work. So as soon as it boots up, we'll go back and try that out and see that it actually did get the right settings. So let's talk a little bit about IaaS and PaaS that are together. So the beauty of using virtual machines is using PaaS. because building PaaS applications with Windows Azure is really powerful. You have basically the ability to infinitely scale out your web and worker roles. It's really easy to build these highly scalable architectures. We take care of patching. We take care of pretty much everything about the platform itself other than you building the application. The downside is lots of customers have lots of code that doesn't run directly in the cloud. So the marriage of the two, putting all that code that doesn't run in a PaaS role inside of a virtual machine and connecting to it through a PaaS, through a virtual network seems to be the easiest approach. Now I'm going to cover three different scenarios on how you can integrate these two together. The first is connecting cloud services via VIPs. So this is no virtual networking whatsoever. You have cloud service within a web role, and you have a SQL server in another cloud service. The reason I'm doing this is because you currently cannot put them in the same cloud service. It's not supported. So how you let the web role talk to the SQL server is you essentially create a public endpoint, like 2001, forwarded back to 1433, and it should actually just work. The strength is it's real simple to do that. Tenant autonomy, if your DBA manages a SQL server and he doesn't want your developers messing with it, you can keep them physically separate and no big deal. They can actually even be in separate subscriptions if you want. For that matter, they can be in separate services. You could host VMs in Windows Azure and applications in GoDaddy or something. It doesn't really matter as long as we're going through public endpoints. The downside is you notice the architecture. You are going out through load balancer A and back in through load balancer B. That's a couple of extra hops. If you're doing a lot of really high I.O., lots of high transactions, that may not be the best strategy for your application. Obviously, it's a little bit less secure because you're putting SQL Server on a public endpoint for anyone could connect to. So you're going to be in charge of using the firewall rules to restrict that so people can't just open up your SQL Server for attack. The second option is connecting cloud services with virtual networks. And like I showed before, you can create a virtual network, and this has... to do this scenario, you don't have to have anything with site-to-site networking. It doesn't require a Cisco device. You literally just define the VNet in cloud, and whenever you deploy your applications into it, you select that VNet. And now all your cloud services can be on the same network, and it makes it for really advanced scenarios. You could literally deploy AD in the cloud. You could do DCOM. You could do BizTalk. All the stuff that you couldn't do before, you can now do just by using a really simple virtual network. So the weaknesses... you have to know what a subnet is. I'm sorry, it's not that hard. But that's really the only weakness, is you have to define that subnet. And also the other weakness is you have no DNS, which kind of is a pain. So the third option that someday we will get to, that's definitely in the works, is PaaS and IaaS in the same cloud service. So this is the idea of you can deploy your web and worker roles and a VM all in the same spot. They have name resolution. They're all on the same network. You don't even have to worry about a VNet. That probably is coming in the future. It's on the roadmap. It's not there yet, though. So the downside is with this model, if we do go down it, is there likely wouldn't be a VIP swap. So if you're familiar with web and worker roles, you have the ability to deploy to a staging slot and then swap it to production and vice versa. And that capability would go away if a VM is in it, because VMs absolutely do not understand VIP swap. So let's walk through a real quick demo, just show you how you can wire this up, just to show you that doing a VNet without hybrid networking is actually fairly simple. Okay, so real quick, I'm going to check to see if my VM booted up yet. And it says it's running. So I'm going to try to ping that guy. And it still shows 192 address. So let's flush DNS, because that's likely cached. So we have successfully migrated our VM. It's now listening on booted up on a cloud VNet IP address. And if I hit that server, if I close this guy and reopen it, it in theory should still work. So while that's floating up, let's jump to our mixed mode. I can tell you, cooking shows, if you guys can follow this, I'll be impressed. actually, let's give it just a second. The reason I know it will work is because it actually did get name resolution. And the only reason I get name resolution is because it booted up and it found AD and it updated DNS. So that's the only reason I know for a fact that someday this VM will actually boot. this. Maybe we will come back here in a second. SharePoint does take a long time to start. Anyone that's used it knows that. So the application I'm going to show you real quick from an architecture standpoint, we're actually not going to deploy it, is real simple, actually. It's an Azure Store application. And you say, oh, that looks like a really simple application. Why not just deploy it all in a web role? Makes sense. Well, this application does something interesting, is I can type in chain and hit search. And it actually returns back results. So using Windows Azure SQL Database, I can't do that. It doesn't support full-text search. So I either have to go get another search engine, or I boot up a SQL Server VM up in the cloud, which is what this application is deployed in. This application right here is actually just two virtual machines. It's ISVM1 and SQL VM1. So the question is, how can I lower my management cost? How can I make the web server scale? How can I get out of the business of running managing some of my application? I can't get out of SQL Server yet because SQL Azure doesn't support it all yet, but I can get rid of some of the management aspects of this app. So I'm going to jump over here. I have the entire application. It's just a real simple ASP.NET app. I'm going to show you how that can be. Oh, and looky there, our SharePoint app deployed. So demo one worked, demo two still ongoing. So this is the Azure Store application as it is working right now in a VM. So all I got to do to convert this to a web role, it's just a web app, is do add Windows Azure Cloud Service Project. And this is actually a really nice feature of Visual Studio 2012. Before, it's actually had like five steps, not a whole lot more work, but if you're a developer, you know, you appreciate being as lazy as you can. So this creates a different role configuration for me. So now instead of, just think about the use case of, okay, so I have Azure Store running on a VM talking to SQL. I really need it running on four VMs talking to SQL. So now I got to go provision three new VMs, patch them, deploy my application, blah, 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 blah. In PaaS, if I want four VMs, I go in here and I type in four. And that's it. Azure takes care of the rest. It deploys your application on four VMs, and you're automatically done. If you want to scale it back, you go there, change it to two, click OK, and it gets rid of two of your VMs. It's really that simple. So the question is, how does my PaaS application talk to my SQL Server on the same virtual network? So what I'm going to do, show you how you can make a real simple VNet, show you the bare bones VNet that you can do to make these two talk. So I'm going to do new custom create as PaaS VNet demo. And address space, I'll just be symbol 10.2.0.0. And for the subnet, call it app subnet. Type in those two addresses, and that's literally everything I need to do from a VNet configuration. I've defined a real basic network that everything I deploy into will all be on the same network. So you already saw how to deploy a VM into a VNet. I create a new VM, I pick the right VNet, click OK, that's it. PaaS is slightly different. There's no button that says use a VNet. You do have to add a little configuration for it. So I'm going to take this and right-clicking it, package. And what package does is it generates a CS package file and a CS configuration file. And CS package is basically the entire application end-to-end that needs to be deployed to Azure. And the service configuration is any configuration settings you want, like instance count or, in this case, networking. So as soon as this thing is open, I'm going to show you how to configure the configuration to make it aware of what VNet to use. Okay. So you can open this up in Visual Studio. If you want, you can open it up in Notepad. It's just a text file. Paste in the network configuration and give it the right naming. So my VNet name was IS PaaS Demo. The role name is Azure Store. And the subnet name is App Subnet. So whenever I deploy this application, it'll be on the same VNet. It'll see SQL. It'll just work. And if you've never deployed a cloud service package before, all that's required is create a new cloud service. Oops, hold on. Went too quick. And I need to check deploy cloud service package now this time. And now I can browse to the CS package in the CS configuration file. That's really all that's required. And the only downside of web cloud services is it does take about 15 minutes to deploy. So like a good presenter, I have the exact same application as a cloud service. So migrate WFC. Here's the exact same application running as a web role talking to a VM. Now, if I go look at the network I configured for it, it'll tell you what all it's in use. So you can see that I have SQL VM1, and I currently have two instances of my web role. Pretty straightforward to have these guys talk to each other. All right, so wrapping up, a few more resources if you want to learn more. WindowsAzure.com, and there's a managed link at the top. You click manage, and there's tons and tons and tons of walkthroughs and how-tos on Windows Azure Infrastructure Service. If you want to follow me, hit my blog on michaelwashington.com. I post all kinds of interesting stuff about PowerShell specifically and infrastructure service, VNet, screencasts, all that good stuff, and WashMMS on Twitter. And for infrastructure service, if you just want to get down and get your hands dirty, the Windows Azure Training Kit has lots and lots of hands-on labs that walk you through provisioning VMs, deploying SharePoint, deploying SQL Server, whatever you want to do. So just to wrap up, we talked a lot about the new IT Pro experience, even mentioned System Center, even though I didn't show it, but we talked about how key server applications such as Active Directory, SQL, SharePoint are all enabled with virtual machines, showed you how we can copy 14 terabytes in about 3 seconds. That's cool from a storage manageability perspective. Talked about availability sets, which is configuring VMs on different racks in your data center. That's actually really hard if you ever manage a data center to go physically architect all your VMs out. Now it's literally just a checkbox and a wizard. And we literally walked through and configured a Cisco device live on stage. That's never worked before. So that's very exciting. And PaaS integration. So apparently you can win a Sculpt Touch Mouse if you complete your session evaluation, so please go do that because these things are apparently really valuable. But no, please do complete your survey. Fill out any feedback. Hopefully you'll get a mouse. And for additional learning and connecting, download the TechEd resources at teched.com/TechEdResources, australia.msteched.com. And that's it. Oh, sorry. If you want to win eligible to win a helicopter trip, tweet, I want to ride in the WindServe heli at Azure TechEd cause and make up some really awesome reason, and maybe you'll win. That's the last marketing slide, I think. Awesome. So thank you very much.